Side 6, Imperial Earth, beginning on page 248. Carl did not answer at once, but bent down and carefully placed his notebook on the most rust-free section of the catwalk he could find. The action reminded Duncan so vividly of old times that he was absurdly moved. Carl had never been able to express his emotions properly unless his hands were free, and that notebook was obviously a major hindrance. "Listen carefully, Duncan," Carl began. "Whatever Kalindi told you, she's told me nothing. She must have helped you find me. Not even that. She doesn't even know I'm here. I don't believe you." Duncan shrugged his shoulders and remained silent. His strategy seemed to be working, by hinting that he knew much more than he did, which was indeed little enough. He hoped to undercut Carl's confidence and gain further admissions from him. But what he would do then, he still had no idea. He could only rely on Colin's maxim of the masterful administration of the unforeseen. Carl had now begun to pace back and forth in such an agitated manner that for the first time, Duncan felt distinctly nervous. He remembered Kalindi's warning, and once again, he reminded himself uneasily that this was not at all a good place for a confrontation with an adversary who might be slightly unbalanced. Suddenly, Carl seemed to come to a decision. He stopped his uncertain weaving along the narrow catwalk and turned on his heel so abruptly that Duncan drew back involuntarily. Then he realized, with both surprise and relief, that Carl's hands were outstretched in a gesture of pleading, not of menace. "Duncan," he began in a voice that was now completely changed, "you can help me. What I'm trying to do..." It was as if the sun had exploded. Duncan threw his hands before his eyes and clenched them tightly against the intolerable glare. He heard a cry from Carl, and a moment later the other bumped into him violently, rebounding at once. The actinic detonation had lasted only a fraction of a second. Could it have been lightning? But if so, where was the thunder? It should have come almost instantaneously for a flash as brilliant as this. Duncan dared to open his eyes and found that he could see again, though through a veil of pinkish mist. But Carl, it was obvious, could not see at all. He was blundering around blindly with his hands cupped tightly over his eyes, and still the expected thunder never came. If Duncan had not been half paralyzed by shock, he might yet have acted in time. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion, as in a dream. He could not believe that it was real. He saw Carl's foot hit the precious notebook so that it went spinning off into space, fluttering downward like some strange white bird. Blinded though he was, Carl must have realized what he had done. Totally disoriented, he made one futile grab at the empty air, then crashed into the guardrail. Duncan tried to reach him, but it was too late. Even then, it might not have mattered, but the years and the rust had done their work. As the treacherous metal parted, it seemed to Duncan that Carl cried out his name in the last second of his life. But of that, he would never be sure. Chapter 38, The Listeners. "You're under no legal compulsion," Ambassador Farrell had explained. "If you wish, I could claim diplomatic immunity for you. But it would be unwise and might lead to various, difficulties. In any case, this inquiry is in the mutual interest of all concerned. We want to find out what's happened just as much as they do. And who are they? Even if I knew, I couldn't tell you. Let's say Terran security. You still have that kind of nonsense here. I thought spies and secret agents went out a couple of hundred years ago. Bureaucracies are self-perpetuating. You should know that. But civilization will always have its discontents, to use a phrase I came across somewhere. Though the police handle most matters, as they do on Titan, there are cases which require special treatment. By the way, I've been asked to make it clear that anything you care to say will be privileged and won't be published without your consent. And if you wish, I will come along with you for moral support and guidance." Even now, Duncan was not quite sure who the ambassador was representing, but the offer was a reasonable one, and he had accepted it. He could see no harm in such a private meeting. Some kind of judicial inquiry was obviously needed, but the less publicity the better. He had half expected to be taken in a blacked-out car on a long, torturous drive to some vast underground complex in the depths of Virginia or Maryland. It was a little disappointing to end up in a small room at the old State Department building, talking to an assistant undersecretary with the improbable name of John Smith. Later checking on Duncan's part disclosed that this actually was his name. However, it soon became clear that there was much more to this room than the plain desk and three comfortable chairs that met the eye. Duncan's suspicions about the large mirror that covered most of one wall were quickly confirmed. His host, or interrogator, if one wanted to be melodramatic, saw the direction of his glance and gave him a candid smile. "With your permission, Mr. McKenzie, we'd like to record this meeting. And there are several other participants watching. They may join in from time to time. If you don't mind, I'll refrain from introducing them." Duncan nodded politely toward the mirror. I've no objection to recording, he said. Do you mind if I also use my Minisec? There was a painful silence, broken only by an ambassadorial chuckle. Then Mr. Smith answered, We would prefer to supply you with a transcript. I can promise that it will be quite accurate. Duncan did not press the point. Presumably, it might cause embarrassment if some of the voices involved were recognized by outsiders. In any case, a transcript would be perfectly acceptable. He could trust his memory to spot errors or deletions. Well, that's fine, said Mr. Smith, obviously relieved. Let's get started. Simultaneously, something odd happened to the room. Its acoustics changed abruptly. It was as if it had suddenly become much larger. There was not the slightest visible alteration, but Duncan had the uncanny feeling of unseen presences all around him. He would never know if they were actually in Washington or on the far side of the earth, and it gave him an uncomfortable, naked sensation to be surrounded by invisible listeners and watchers. A moment later, a voice spoke quietly from the air immediately in front of him. Good morning, Mr. Mackenzie. It's good of you to spare us your time, and please excuse our reticence. If you think this is some kind of 20th century spy melodrama, our apologies. 99 times out of 100, these precautions are totally unnecessary, but we can never tell which occasion will be the 100th. It was a friendly, powerful voice, very deep and resonant, yet there was something slightly unnatural about it. A computer? Duncan asked himself. That was too easy an assumption. In any case, there was no way of distinguishing between computer vocalization and human speech, especially now that a realistic number of errs, wells, incomplete sentences, and downright grammatical errors could be incorporated to make the non-electronic participants in a conversation feel at ease. He guessed that he was listening to a man talking through a speech-disguising circuit. While Duncan was still trying to decide if any answer was necessary, another speaker took over. This time the voice emerged about half a meter from his left ear. It's only fair to reassure you on one point, Mr. Mackenzie. As far as we can ascertain, no Terran laws have been broken. We are not here to investigate a crime, only to solve a mystery, to explain a tragedy. If any Titanian regulations are involved, that is your problem, not ours. I hope you understand. Yes, Duncan replied. I assumed that was the case, but I'm glad to have your confirmation. This was indeed a relief, but he knew better than to relax. Perhaps this statement was exactly what it seemed to be, a friendly plea for cooperation, but it might also be a trap. Now a woman's voice came from immediately behind him, and he had to resist the impulse to swing around and look at the speaker. Was this quite unnecessary shifting of sound focus a deliberate attempt to disorient him? How naive did they take him to be? To save us all time, let me explain that we have a complete summary of Mr. Helmer's background. And mine, thought Duncan. Your government has been most helpful, but you may have information which is unknown to us, since you were one of his closest friends. Duncan nodded without bothering to speak. They would know all about that friendship and its ending. As if responding to some hidden signal, Mr. Smith opened his briefcase and carefully laid a small object on the table. You'll recognize this, of course, the female voice continued. The Helmer family had asked that it be handed over to you for safe custody with the other property of the deceased. The sight of Carl's Minisec, virtually the same model as his own, was in itself such a shock that at first the remainder of the message failed to get through. Then Duncan reacted with a start and said, Would you please repeat that? There was such a surprisingly long delay that he wondered if the speaker was on the moon. During the course of the session, Duncan became almost certain of it. With all the other interrogators, there was a quick give and take, but with a lone woman, there was always this invariable time lag. The Helmers have asked that you be custodian of their son's effects until disposition is settled. It was a gesture of peace, across the grave of all their hopes, and Duncan felt his eyes stinging with unshed tears. He looked at the handful of microelectronics on the table and felt a deep reluctance even to touch it. There were all Carl's secrets. Would the Helmers have asked him to accept this if they had anything to hide? But there was a great deal, Duncan was certain, that Carl had concealed from his own family. There would be much in the Minisec that only he had ever known. True, it would be guarded by carefully chosen code words, some meant unauthorized intrusion. Naturally, continued the voice from the moon, if it was from the moon, we are interested in what may be in this Minisec. In particular, we would like any list of contacts on Earth, addresses or personal numbers. Yes, thought Duncan, I can understand that. I'm sure you must have been tempted to do some interrogation already, but are scared of possible erase circuits and want to explore other alternatives first. He stared thoughtfully at that little box on the table with its multitudinous studs and its now darkened readout panel. There lay a device of complexity beyond all the dreams of earlier ages, a virtual micro-simulacrum of a human brain. Within it were billions of bits of information, stored in endless atomic arrays, awaiting to be recalled by the right signal or obliterated by the wrong one. At the moment, it was lifeless, inert, like consciousness itself in the profoundest depths of sleep. No, not quite inert. The clock and calendar circuits would still be operating, ticking off the seconds and minutes and days that now were no concern of Carl's. Another voice broke in, this time from the right. We have asked Mr. Armand Helmer if his son left any code words with him, as is usual in such cases. You may be hearing more on the matter shortly. Meanwhile, no attempt will be made to obtain any readouts. With your permission, we would like to retain the Minisec for the present. Duncan was getting a little tired of having decisions made for him, and the Helmers had apparently stated that he was to take possession of Carl's effects. But there was no point in objecting, and if he did, some legal formality would undoubtedly materialize out of the same thin air as these mysterious voices. Mr. Smith was digging into his case again. Now there's a second matter. I'm sure you'll also recognize this. Yes, Carl usually carried a sketchbook. Is this the one he had with him when... It is. Would you like to go through it and see if there is anything that strikes you as unusual, noteworthy, of any possible value to this investigation? Even if it seems utterly trivial or irrelevant, please don't hesitate to speak. What a technological gulf, thought Duncan, between these two objects. The Minisec was a triumph of the neo-electronic age. The sketchbook had existed virtually unchanged for at least 1,000 years, and so had the pencil tucked into it. It was very true, as some philosopher of history had once said, that mankind never completely abandons any of its ancient tools. Yet Carl's sketchbooks had always been something of an affectation. He could make competent engineering drawings, but had never shown any genuine sign of artistic talent. As Duncan slowly turned the leaves, he was acutely conscious of the hidden eyes all around him. Without the slightest doubt, every page here had been carefully recorded, using all the techniques that could bring out invisible marks and erasures. It was hard to believe that he could add much to the investigations that had already been made. Carl apparently used his sketchbooks to make notes of anything that interested him, to conduct a sort of dialogue with himself, and to express his emotions. There were cryptic words and numbers in small, precise handwriting, fragments of calculations and equations, mathematical sketches. And there were spacescapes, obviously rough drawings of scenes on the outer moons, with the formalized circle and ellipse of Saturn hanging in the sky, circuit diagrams with more calculations, full of lambdas and omegas, and vector notations that Duncan could recognize but could not understand. And then suddenly, bursting out of the pages of impersonal notes and rather inept sketches, something that breathed life, something that might have been the work of a real artist, a portrait of Kalindi, drawn with obvious, loving care. It should have been instantly recognizable, yet strangely enough, for a fraction of a second, Duncan stared at it blankly. This was not the Kalindi he now knew, for the real woman was already obliterating the image from the past. Here was Kalindi, as they had both remembered her, the girl frozen forever in the bubble stereo beyond the reach of time. Duncan looked at the picture for long minutes before turning the page. It was really excellent. Quite unlike all the other sketches, but then, how many times had Carl drawn it, over and over again, during the intervening years? No one spoke from the air around him or interrupted his thoughts, and presently he moved on. More calculations, patterns of hexagons, dwindling away into the distance. Why, of course. That's the Titanite lattice. But the number written against it means nothing to me. It looks like a Terran Vidi coding. You are correct. It happens to be the number of a gem expert here in Washington, not Ivor Mandelstam, in case you're wondering. The person concerned assures us that Mr. Helmer never contacted him, and we believe him. It's probably a number he acquired somehow, jotted down, but never used. More calculations, now with lots of frequencies and phase angles. Doubtless communication stuff, part of Carl's regular work. Geometrical doodles, many of them based on the hexagon motive. Kalindi again. Only an outline sketch this time, showing none of the loving care of the earlier drawing. A honeycomb pattern of little circles seen in plan and elevation. Only a few were drawn in detail, but it was obvious that there must be hundreds. The interpretation was equally obvious. The Cyclops array. Yes, he's written in the number of elements and the overall dimensions. Why do you think he was so interested? That's quite natural. It's the biggest and most famous radio telescope on Earth. He often discussed it with me. Did he ever speak of visiting it? Very likely, but I don't remember. After all, this was some years ago. The drawings on the next few pages, though very rough and diagrammatic, were clearly details of Cyclops. Antenna feeds, tracking mechanisms, obscure bits of circuitry, interspersed with yet more calculations. One sketch had been started and never finished. Duncan looked at it sadly, then turned the page. As he had expected, the next sheet was blank. "I'm sorry to disappoint you," he said, closing the book, "but I get nothing at all from this. Carl, Mr. Helmer's field was communication science. He helped design the Titan Inner Planets link. This is all part of his work. His interest is completely understandable, and I see nothing unusual about it." "Perhaps so, Mr. Mackenzie, but you haven't finished." Duncan looked in surprise at the empty air. Then Undersecretary Smith gestured toward the sketchbook. "Never take anything for granted," he said mildly. "Start at the other end." Feeling slightly foolish, Duncan reopened the sketchbook, then flipped it over as he realized that Carl had used it from both directions. But he had been badly shaken by those last drawings and was not thinking too clearly. The inside back cover was blank, but the facing page bore the single enigmatic word Argus. It meant nothing to Duncan, though it did arouse some faint and unidentifiable association from history. He turned the page and had one of the biggest shocks of his life. As he stared incredulously at the drawing that occupied the entire area of the paper, he was suddenly transported back to Golden Reef. There could be no misinterpretation. Yet as far as he knew, Carl had never shown the slightest interest in the minutiae of terrestrial zoology. The very idea that any Titanian might be fascinated by marine biology was faintly incongruous. Yet here was a detailed study, with the perspective meticulously worked out around the faintly limbed X, Y, and Z axes of the spiny sea urchin, Diadema. Only a dozen of its thin, radiating needles were shown, but it was clear that there were hundreds occupying the entire sphere's face around it. That was astonishing enough, but there was something even more remarkable. This drawing must have required hours of devoted labor. Carl had dedicated to an unprepossessing little invertebrate, which surely he could never have seen in his life, all the love and skill he had applied to the portrait of Kalindi. In the bright sunshine outside the old State Department, Duncan and the ambassador had to wait for 5 minutes before the next shuttle came gliding silently down Virginia Avenue. No one was within earshot, so Duncan said with quiet urgency, "Does Argus mean anything to you?" "As a matter of fact, yes, though I'm damned if I see how it can help. I still have the remnants of a classical education, and unless I'm very much mistaken, Argus was the name of Odysseus' old dog. It recognized him when he came home to Ithaca after his 20 years of wandering, then died." Duncan brooded over this information for a few seconds, then shrugged his shoulders. "You're right. That's no help at all. And I still want to know why these people I met, or didn't meet, are so interested in Carl. As they admitted at the start, there's no suggestion that he's done anything illegal as far as Earth is concerned. And I suspect that he may have only bent some Titanian regulations, not broken them."
Just a moment,
said the ambassador. "You've reminded me of something." His face went through some rather melodramatic contortions, then smoothed itself out. He glanced around conspiratorially, saw that there was no one within hearing, and that the shuttle was still 3 minutes away by the countdown indicator. "I think I may have it, and I'll be obliged if you don't attribute this to me. But just consider the following wild speculation. Every organism has defense mechanisms to protect itself. You've just encountered one, part of the security system of Earth. This particular group, whatever its responsibilities may be, probably consists of a fairly small number of important people. I expect I know most of them. In fact, one voice... never mind. You could call it a watchdog committee. Such a committee has to have a name for itself. A secret name, naturally. In the course of my duties, I occasionally hear of such things and carefully forget them. Now, Argus was a watchdog. So what better name for such a group? Mind you, I'm still not asserting anything. But imagine the acute embarrassment of a secret organization that happens to find its name carefully spelled out in highly mysterious circumstances." It was a very plausible theory, and Duncan was sure that the ambassador would not have advanced it without excellent reasons. But it did not go even halfway. "That's all very well, and I'm prepared to accept it. But what the devil has all this to do with a drawing of a sea urchin? I feel I'm going slowly mad." The shuttle was now gliding to a halt in front of them, and the ambassador waved him into it. "If it's any consolation, Duncan, be assured that you're in very good company. I'd sacrifice a fair share of my modest retirement benefits if I could eavesdrop now on Undersecretary Smith and his invisible friends." Chapter 39. Business and Desire. There was no way of telling, as Duncan stood at the window of Kalindi's apartment, that he was not looking down at the busy traffic of 57th Street on a crisp winter night when the first flakes of snow were drifting down to melt at once as they struck the heated sidewalks. But this was summer, not winter, And even President Bernstein's limousine was not as old as the cars moving silently 100 meters below. He was watching the past, perhaps a hologram from the late 20th century. Yet though Duncan knew that he was actually far underground, there was nothing that he could do to convince his senses of this fact. He was alone with Kalindi at last, though in circumstances of which he could never have dreamed only a few days ago. How ironic that now the opportunity had come, he felt barely the faintest flicker of desire. "What is it?" he asked suspiciously as Kalindi handed him a slim crystal goblet containing a few centimeters of blood-red liquid. "If I told you the name, would mean nothing. And if I said what it cost, you'd be scared to drink it. Just taste it slowly. You'll never have another chance, and it will do you good." It was good. Smooth, slightly sweet, and Duncan was quite certain, charged with several megatons of slumbering energy. He sipped it very slowly indeed, watching Kalindi as she moved around the room. He had not really known what to expect, yet her apartment had still been something of a surprise. It was almost stark in its simplicity, but large and beautifully proportioned, with dove-gray walls, a blue vaulted ceiling like the sky itself, and a green carpet that gave the impression of a small sea of grass lapping against the walls. There were fewer than a dozen pieces of furniture, 4 deeply cushioned chairs, 2 divans, a closed writing desk, a glass cabinet full of delicate chinaware, a low table upon which were lying a small box and a splendid book on 22nd century primitives, and of course the ubiquitous console, its screen now crawling with abstract art that was very far from primitive. Even without the force of gravity to remind him, there was no danger that Duncan would forget he was on Earth. He doubted if a private home on any other planet could show a display like this, but he would not like to live here. Everything was a little too perfect, and displayed altogether too clearly the Terran obsession with the past. He suddenly remembered Ambassador Farrell's remark, "We aren't decadent, but our children will be." That would include Kalindi's generation. Perhaps the ambassador was right. He took another sip, staring at Kalindi in silence as she orbited the room. Clearly ill at ease, she moved a chair through an imperceptible fraction of an inch and gave a picture an equally invisible adjustment. Then she came back to the divan and sat down beside him. A little more purposefully now, she leaned across the low coffee table and picked up the box lying upon it. "Have you seen one of these?" she asked as she opened the lid. Lying in a nest of velvet was something that looked like a large silver egg, about twice the size of the real eggs that Duncan had encountered in the Centennial Hotel. "What is it?" he asked. "A piece of sculpture?" "Pick it up, but be careful not to drop it." Despite this warning, that was very nearly what he did. The egg was not particularly heavy, but it seemed alive, even squirming in his hand, though it showed no sign of any visible movement. However, when he looked at it more carefully, he could see faint opalescent bands flowing over the surface and momentarily blurring the mirror finish. They looked very much like waves of heat, yet there was no sensation of warmth. "Cup it in both hands," Kalindi instructed him, "and close your eyes." Duncan obeyed, despite an almost irresistible impulse to see what was really happening to the extraordinary object he held. He felt completely disoriented, because it seemed that the sense of touch, the most reliable of all man's messengers from the external universe, was betraying him. For the very texture of the egg was constantly changing. It no longer felt like metal. Unbelievably, it was furry. He might have been fondling some small woolly animal, a kitten, perhaps, but only for seconds. The egg shivered, became hard and rough. It was made of sandpaper, coarse enough to grate the skin. The sandpaper became satin, so smooth and silky that he wanted to caress it. There was barely time to obey the impulse when the egg was liquefying and becoming gelatinous. It seemed about to ooze through his fingers, and Duncan had to force himself not to drop it in disgust. Only the knowledge that this could not really be happening gave him strength to control the reflex. It was made of wood. There was no doubt of that, for he could even feel the grain. Before it dissolved into myriads of separate bristles, each so sharp and distinct that he could feel them prickling his skin. And there were sensations that he could not even name, some delightful, most neutral, but some so unpleasant that he could scarcely control his revulsion. At last, when within his cupped palms Duncan felt the unique, the incomparable touch of human skin, curiosity and amazement got the better of him. He opened his hands. The silver egg was completely unchanged, though now it felt as if it were carved from soap. "What in heaven's name is it?" he cried. "It's a tactoid. You haven't heard of them?" "No." "Fascinating, isn't it? It does to the sense of touch what a kaleidoscope does to vision. No, don't ask me how it works. Something to do with controlled electrical stimulation. What's it used for?" "Must everything have a purpose? It's just a toy, a novelty. But I had a very good reason for showing it to you. Oh, I know, the latest from Earth. Kalindi gave a wistful smile. She recognized that old catchphrase. It brought back vividly to both of them those days together on Titan, a lifetime ago. Duncan, she said so quietly that he could barely hear the words, do you think it was all my fault? They were now sitting 2 meters apart on the divan, and he had to twist his body to face her. The woman he saw now was no longer the self-assured executive and impresario he had met on the Titanic, but an unhappy and uncertain girl. He wondered how long the mood of contrition would last, but for the moment it was genuine enough. How can I answer that, he replied. I'm still completely in the dark. I don't know what Carl was doing on Earth, or why he came here. This was only partially true. Carl's Minisec had begun to reveal its secrets, but Duncan was not yet prepared to discuss those with anybody, least of all with Kalindi. She looked at him with an air of faint surprise and answered, do you mean to say that he never told you in 15 years? Told me what? Said Duncan. What happened on that last night aboard Mentor? No, replied Duncan with painful slowness. He never talked about it. After all these years, that betrayal was still a bitter memory. He knew now, of course, that it was absurd for two young adults like Carl and Kalindi, obsessed by their own grief, to have given any thought to the feelings of the boy who adored them both. He could not blame them now, but in his heart he had never forgiven them. So you didn't know that we used a joy machine? Oh, no. I'm afraid so. It wasn't my idea. Carl insisted, and I didn't know any better. But at least I had sense enough not to use it myself. Well, only at very low power. They were illegal even in those days. How did one get aboard Mentor? There were a lot of things on Mentor that no one ever knew about. I'm sure of that. What happened? Kalindi got to her feet again and began to pace nervously to and fro. She avoided Duncan's eyes as she continued. I don't like to think about it. Even now it frightens me, and I can understand why people get hopelessly addicted. I'm sure your fingers have never touched anything as... well, I suppose palpable is the only word, is that tactoid. The joy machine is just the same. It makes real life seem pale and thin. And Carl, remember, used it at full power. I told him not to, but he laughed. He was confident that he could handle it. Yes, thought Duncan, that would be just like Carl. Though he had never seen an emotion amplifier, one was kept under proper supervision at the Oasis Central Hospital. It was a very valuable psychiatric tool, but when the simple portable versions, quickly christened joy machines, had become available around the mid-century, they had spread like a plague over the inhabited worlds. No one would ever know how many immature young minds had been ruined by them. Brain burning had been a disease of the 60s, until the epidemic had run its course, leaving behind it hundreds of emotional husks. Carl had been lucky to escape. But, of course, he had not escaped. So this was the truth about his breakdown, and the explanation of his changed personality. Duncan began to feel a cold anger toward Kalindi. He did not believe her protestation of innocence. She must have known better even then. But part of his anger was not based on moral judgments. He blamed Kalindi because she was alive, while Carl lay frozen in the Aden morgue, like some splendid marble statue defaced by time and carelessly restored. There he must wait until the legal complications involved in the disposal of an extraterrestrial corpse were unraveled. This was another duty that had fallen upon Duncan. He had done everything he believed necessary before saying farewell to the friend he had lost before his death. I think I see the picture, continued Duncan so harshly that Kalindi looked at him with a sudden surprise. But tell me the rest. What happened then? Carl used to send me long, crazy speeches, sealed, special delivery. He said he would never be able to love anyone else. I told him not to be foolish, but to forget me as quickly as he could, since we'd never be able to meet again. What else could I have said? I didn't realize how absolutely useless that advice was, like telling a man to stop breathing. I was ashamed to ask, and only discovered years later what a joy machine does to the brain. You see, Duncan, he was telling the literal truth when he said he could never love anyone else. When they reinforce the pleasure circuits, joy machines create a permanent, almost unbreakable pattern of desires. The psychologists call it electro-imprinting. I believe that there are techniques to modify it now, but there weren't 15 years ago, even on Earth, and certainly not on Titan. After a while, I stopped answering. There was nothing I could say. But I still heard from Carl several times a year. He swore that sooner or later he would get to Earth and see me again. I didn't take him seriously. Perhaps not, thought Duncan, but I'm sure you weren't wholly displeased. It must have been flattering to have held in your hand the soul of someone as talented and beautiful as Carl. even if he had been enslaved accidentally with the aid of a machine. He saw very clearly now why all Carl's later liaisons and marriages had exploded violently. They had been doomed to failure at the start. Always the image of Kalindi would have stood, an unattainable ideal between Carl and happiness. How lonely he must have been, and how many misunderstandings might have been averted if the cause of his behavior had been realized in time. Yet perhaps nothing could have been done, and in any case it was futile to dream about missed opportunities. Who was the old philosopher who had said, "The human race will never know happiness as long as the words, if only, can still be spoken"? So, it must have been a surprise when he finally did turn up. No. He'd dropped several hints. I'd been half expecting him for a year. Then he called me from Port Van Allen, said he'd just arrived on a special flight, and would be seeing me as soon as he'd completed his gravity reconditioning. It was a Terran survey supply ship, going back empty and fast. Even so, it took him 50 days. And it couldn't have been a very comfortable trip, Duncan added to himself. 50 days inside one of those space trucks, with minimal life support systems. What a contrast to Sirius. He felt sorry for the officers who had innocently succumbed to Carl's persuasion, and hoped that the current court of inquiry would not damage their careers. Kalindi had recovered some of her poise. She stopped pacing around and rejoined Duncan on the divan. I was not sure whether I really wanted to see him again after all these years, but I knew how determined he was. It would have been useless trying to keep him away. So I suppose you can say I took the line of least resistance. She managed a wry smile, then continued, "It didn't work, of course, and I should have known it. Then we saw in a newscast that you'd just arrived on Earth. That must have been a shock to Carl. What did he say?" "Not much. But I could see that he was upset and very surprised. Surely he must have made some comment." "Only that if you contacted me, I was not to tell you that he was on Earth. That was the first time I suspected something was wrong and started to worry about the Titanite he'd asked me to sell." "That's a trivial matter. Forget about it. Let's say it was just one of the many tools that Carl used to reach his objective. But I'd like to know this. When we met aboard Titanic, was he still with you?" Another hesitation, which in itself supplied half the answer. Then Kalindi replied rather defiantly, "Of course he was. And he was very angry when I said I'd met you. We had a bad row over that, not the first one." She sighed, slightly too dramatically. By that time, even Carl realized that it wouldn't work, that it was quite hopeless. I'd warned him many times, but he wouldn't believe me. He refused to face the fact that the Kalindi he'd known 15 years before, and whose image was burned in his brain, no longer existed. Duncan had never thought that he would see tears in Kalindi's eyes. But was she weeping for Carl, he wondered, or for her own lost youth? He tried to be cynical, but he did not succeed. He was sure that some part of her sorrow was perfectly genuine, and despite himself was deeply touched by it. And more than touched, for now, to his great surprise, he found that sympathy was not the only emotion Kalindi was arousing in him. He had never realized before that shared grief could be an aphrodisiac. This was a development that he did nothing to discourage, but he did not want to hurry matters. There was still much that he hoped to learn, and that only Kalindi could tell him. "So he was always disappointed when we made love," she continued tearfully, "though at first he tried to conceal it. I could tell, and it wasn't pleasant for me. It made me feel inadequate. You see, by this time I'd learned a good deal about imprinting and knew exactly what the trouble was. Carl's case isn't unique. So he got more and more frustrated, and also violent. Sometimes he frightened me. You know how strong he was. Look at this." With another theatrical gesture, she slipped open her dress, displaying the upper left arm, not to mention her entire left breast. "He hit me here so hard that I was badly bruised. You can still see the mark." With the best will in the world, Duncan could discover no trace of a bruise on the milky white skin, smooth as satin that was exposed before his eyes. Nevertheless, the revelation did not leave him unmoved. "So that's why you switched off the vidi," he said sympathetically and edged closer. "Then Ivor's friend called me with that query about Titan. I thought it was an odd coincidence. You know, Duncan, that was an unkind trick to play on me." She sounded more sad than angry, and she did not move away from him. Almost half of the sofa was now unoccupied. "And then everything started to happen at once. Did you know that Terran Security sent two of its agents to interview me?" "No, but I guessed it." "What did you tell them?" "Everything, of course. They were very kind and understanding." "And also clumsy," said Duncan with deep bitterness. "Oh, Duncan, that was an accident. You were an important guest. You had to be protected. There would have been an interplanetary scandal if something had happened just before you were going to address Congress. But you should never have gone after Carl in such a dangerous place." "It wasn't dangerous. We were having a perfectly friendly discussion. How did I know that trigger-happy idiot was lurking in the next antenna? What was he to do? He'd been ordered to protect you at all costs, and had been warned that Carl might be violent. It looked as if you were starting to fight, and that laser blast would only have blinded Carl for a few hours. It was all a terrible accident. No one was to blame. Perhaps, thought Duncan, it would be a long, long time before he could view the whole sequence of events dispassionately. If there was blame, it was spread thinly and across two worlds. Like most human tragedies, this one had been caused not by evil intentions, but by errors of judgment, misunderstandings. If Malcolm and Colin had not insisted that he have a showdown with Carl, confronting him with the facts, if he had not wanted Carl to prove his innocence and deliberately given him the opportunity to assert it, even to the extent, unconsciously, but he was aware of it now, of putting himself in his power, perhaps Carl had been really dangerous. That was something else he would never know. It seemed as if they had both been enmeshed in some complex web of fate from which there had never been any possibility of escape. And though the scale of that disaster was so much greater that the very comparison appeared ludicrous, Duncan was again reminded of the Titanic. She too had been doomed, as if the gods themselves conspired against her by a whole series of apparently random and trivial chances. If the radioed warnings had not been buried under greetings and business messages, if that iceberg had not sliced so incredibly through all those watertight compartments, if the radio operator on the ship only 20 kilometers away had not gone off duty when the first of all SOS signals was flashed into the Atlantic night, if there had been enough lifeboats, it was like the failure of a whole series of safety devices, one by one, against incalculable odds, until catastrophe was inevitable. "Perhaps you're right," said Duncan, trying to console himself as much as Kalindi. "I don't really blame anyone. Not even Carl. Poor Carl. He really loved me. To have come all the way to Earth." Duncan did not answer, though for a moment he was tempted. Surely Kalindi did not believe that this was the only reason. Even a brain-burned man imprinted by one of those diabolical joy machines was driven by more than passion. And Carl's main objective had been so awesome that even now, Duncan could scarcely believe the picture that was slowly emerging from his sketchbook and the guarded portions of his minisec. Carl had had a dream, or a nightmare, and Duncan was the only man alive who even partially understood it. How utterly baffled and bewildered the Argus committee must be. That thought gave Duncan a heady sense of power, though there were times when he wished that the burden of knowledge had reached him in some other way, or had not come at all. For power and happiness were incompatible. Carl had reached for both, and both had slipped through his fingers. How Duncan could profit by that lesson he did not yet know, but it would be with him for all the years to come. But if happiness was perhaps unattainable, at least pleasure was not beyond his grasp, nor was it to be despised. For a few moments he could forget the affairs of state and turn his back upon an enigma far more profound than any of those that Kalindi peddled to her clients. It was strange how the wheel had gone full circle. 15 years ago he and Carl had turned to each other in shared sorrow for the loss of Kalindi. Now he and Kalindi were mourning Carl. And presently Duncan knew, though it could be only a faint shadow of that unassuageable hunger, something of the disappointment Carl must have experienced. How true it was that one could never quite recover the past. It was almost as good as he had hoped, but one thing was lacking. Kalindi no longer tasted of honey. Chapter 40. Argus Panoptes. So they had the wrong Argus. If this were a time for humor, Duncan would have felt like laughing. Colin had put him on the track with one of his usual economical telexes. It should not have been necessary to go all the way to Titan to check such an elementary point. "Which Argus do you mean?" Colin had asked. There were three. A couple of minutes with the Comsol's encyclopedia section had confirmed this. As Ambassador Farrell had recalled, Argus was indeed Odysseus' faithful old watchdog, who had recognized his master when the Wanderer returned from exile. The name was certainly appropriate for a secret intelligence organization, though now that Duncan had started making inquiries, it turned out that the Argus Committee was not as secret as it might have wished. Bernie Petras, needless to say, had heard of it. So had George Washington, who admitted with some embarrassment, "Of course they've asked me questions, but there's nothing to worry about." Ivor Mandelstam had been more forthcoming, even a little sarcastic. "I'm used to secrecy in my business, and I could teach these people a thing or two. They wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes under Stalin, or even the old Tsars, but I suppose they're necessary. Society will always need some warning system to spot malcontents before they can cause real trouble. I only doubt if any system will really work when it's needed. The second Argus had been the builder of Jason's mythical, or perhaps not-so-mythical, ship, the Argo. Duncan had never heard of the Golden Fleece, and the legend fascinated him. Argo would be a good name for a spaceship, he thought. But even this association had nothing to do with Carl Helmer's notes. He wondered how Carl had ever come across the third Argus. His inquisitive mind had wandered down many byways of fantasy as well as science. And now that he had the key, Duncan understood why the project that had clearly dominated Carl's later years could have only one name, that of the all-seeing, multiple-eyed god Argus Panoptes, who could look in every direction simultaneously, unlike poor Cyclops, who had only a single line of vision. There had been a delay of almost 30 hours before the legal computer on Titan could probate Carl's will. Then Armand Helmar reported that, as Duncan had hoped, it contained a list of obvious code words, presumably the key to the Minisec's private memories. Armand had been perfectly willing to telex the codes, and Duncan had stopped him just in time. Thanks to recent experience, the naive young Mackenzie, who had arrived on Earth only a few weeks ago, had now developed a mild paranoia. He hoped that it would not become obsessive, as sometimes seemed to be the case with Colin, yet perhaps Colin was right. Not until the Argus Committee had, with some reluctance, handed over Carl's Minisec, did Duncan allow Armand to radio the codes from Titan. Now, it would not matter even if they were intercepted. He alone could use them. In all, there were a dozen combinations with identical formats. Each began with a G/T, or go-to, instruction, followed by the 6 binary digits, 101000. That might be an arbitrary number, but it was more likely to have some mnemonic association. A common trick was to use one's day or year of birth. Carl had been born in 40, and Duncan was not surprised at the answer when he converted 101000 to base 10, though he was a little disappointed at so obvious a subterfuge. Yet the code was secure enough, for the chances were astronomically remote that anyone, in a random search, would ever have hit upon the alphabetical sequences that followed. Though they were easy to remember, at least for a Titanian, they were safe from accidental triggering. Each was a name spelled backward, another old trick, but one which never lost its effectiveness. The list began with G/T, 101000, SAMIM, and continued with G/T, 101000, SYHTET, G/T, 101000, SUNAJ, G/T, 101000, ENOID, G/T, 101000, EBEOHP. Then Carl grew tired of moons, for the next, unsurprisingly, was G/T, 101000, DNAMRA. That would certainly be a personal message, and so, of course, would be G/T, 101000, YDNILAC. There was no G/T, 101000, NACNUD, though it was unreasonable to have expected it. Duncan still felt a momentary flicker of regret. A few more family names, but he scarcely noticed them, for his eyes had already caught the final entry, G/T, 101000, SUGRA. The search was ended. But it was not yet successful. There could be one last barrier. Most men had some secrets that they wished to preserve inviolate, even after death. It was still possible that unless these codes were used correctly, they might trigger an erase instruction. Possible, but unlikely. Carl had clearly intended these memories to be released, or he would not have left the codes in his will, with no warning attached to them. Perhaps the wisest move would be to telex Armand again, just in case Carl had left any further instructions that his distraught father had overlooked. That would take hours, and it might still prove nothing. Duncan scanned the list again, looking for clues and finding none. The sequence 101000 might mean erase. He could speculate forever and get nowhere. There was no number sign or execute sign at the end of the sequences, but that proved nothing at all, for few people bothered to write down anything so obvious. 9 times out of 10, it was omitted as understood. Yet one of the standard ways of canceling a secret erase order was to hit execute twice in quick succession. Another was to do so with a definite interval between the two keyings. Did Carl's omission have any significance? or was he merely following the usual convention? The problem contained its own solution, though emotion, rather than intelligence, pointed the way to it. Duncan could see no flaw, though he explored every possibility that he could imagine. Then, feeling a faint trace of guilt, he tapped out G/T 101000YNDILAC, pausing for a fraction of a second before he completed the sequence with number sign. If he was wrong, Kalindi would never know what she had lost. And though Carl's last message to her might have been erased, none of the other stored memories would be placed in hazard. His fears were groundless. Duncan heard only the opening words. "Hello, Kalindi. When you hear this, I shall be..." Before he hit the stop key and the minisec became silent again. He was after bigger game. Perhaps one day, when he had the time... No, that was a temptation. He would be strong enough to resist. And so, in the secluded luxury of the Centennial Hotel, with a do-not-disturb block on all visitors and incoming messages, Duncan keyed G/T 101000SUGRA, number sign. For 2 days, he canceled his appointments and had all meals sent up to his room. Occasionally, he made an outgoing call to check upon some technical point, but most of the time he was alone, communing with the dead. Finally, he was ready to meet the Argus Committee again, on his own terms. He understood everything, except, of course, the greatest mystery of all. How delighted Carl would have been if he had ever known about Golden Reef. The room had not changed, and perhaps the invisible audience was the same, but there was now no trace of the slightly uncertain Duncan Mackenzie who, only a few days ago, had wondered if he should opt for diplomatic immunity. They had accepted without any dispute his explanation of the word Argus, though he did not imagine they were much impressed by his suddenly acquired knowledge of classical mythology. He could tell from the brief questioning that there was a certain disappointment. Perhaps the committee would have to find some other justification for its existence. Was there really an organized underground movement on Terra, or was it merely a joke? This was hardly the right time to ask, though Duncan was tempted. Yet, ironically, there was a small conspiracy in this very room, a conspiracy mutually agreed upon. The committee had guessed that he now appreciated the significance of the name Argus to Terran security, and he knew that it knew. Each side understood the other perfectly, and the next item of business was quickly adopted. So, what was Mr. Helmer's Argus? Asked the woman whom Duncan had tentatively placed upon the moon. And can you account for his odd behavior? Duncan opened the stained notebook to display that astonishing full-page sketch which had so transfixed him at its first revelation. Even now that he knew its true scale, he could not think of it as anything except a drawing of a sea urchin. The diadema was only 30 or 40 centimeters across. Argus would be at least 1,000 kilometers in diameter, if Carl's analysis was right, and of that Duncan no longer had any doubt, though he could never give his full reasons. Carl Helmer had a vision, he began. I'll try to pass it on as best I can, though this is not my field of knowledge. But I knew his psychology, and perhaps I can make you understand what he was trying to do. You may be disappointed again, he told himself. You may dismiss the whole concept as a crazy scientist's delusion, but you'll be wrong. This could be infinitely more important than some trivial conspiracy threatening your tidy little world. Carl was a scientist who always hoped to make some great discovery, but never did. Though he was highly imaginative, even his wildest flights were always soundly based on reality, and he was ambitious. If it were so, murmured a quiet voice from the air beside him, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. Sorry, please continue. The reference was unfamiliar to Duncan, and he showed his annoyance at the interruption by pausing for a few seconds. He was interested in everything, too many things, perhaps. But his great passion was the still unsolved CETI problem, communications with extraterrestrial intelligence. We used to argue about it for hours when we were boys. I could never be quite sure when he was completely serious, but I am now. Why have we never detected radio signals from the advanced societies, which must surely be out there in space? Carl had many theories, but in the end, he settled on the simplest. It's not original, and I'm sure you've heard it before. We ourselves broadcast radio signals for only about 100 years, roughly spanning the 20th century. By the end of that time, we'd switched to cable and optical and satellite systems, concentrating all their power where it was needed, and not spilling most of it wastefully to the stars. This may well be true of all civilizations with a technology comparable to ours. They only pollute the universe with indiscriminate radio noise for a century or two, a very brief fraction of their entire history. So even if there are millions of advanced societies in this galaxy, there may be barely a handful just where we were 300 years ago, still splashing out radio waves in all directions. And the laws of probability make it most unlikely that any of these early electronic cultures will be within detection range. The nearest may be thousands of light years away. But before we abandon the search, we should explore all the possibilities. And there's one that has never been investigated, because until now there was little we could do about it. For three centuries, we've been studying radio waves in the centimeter and meter bands. But we have almost completely ignored the very long waves, tens and hundreds of kilometers in length. Now, of course, there were several good reasons for this neglect. In the first case, it's impossible to study these waves on Earth. They don't get through the ionosphere, and so never reach the surface. You have to go into space to observe them. But for the very longest waves, it's no good merely going up to orbit, or to the other side of the moon, where Cyclops II was built. You have to go halfway out to the limits of the solar system. For the Sun has an ionosphere, just like the Earth's, except that it's billions of times larger. It absorbs all waves more than 10 or 20 kilometers in length. If we want to detect these, we have to go out to Saturn. Such waves have been observed, but only on a few occasions. About 40 years ago, a solar survey mission picked them up. It wasn't looking for radio waves at all, but was measuring magnetic fields between Jupiter and Saturn. It observed pulsations that must have been due to a radio burst at around 15 kilohertz, corresponding to a wavelength of 20 kilometers. At first, it was thought that they came from Jupiter, which is still full of electromagnetic surprises, but that source was eventually ruled out, and the origin is still a mystery. There have been half a dozen observations since then, all of them by instruments that were measuring something else. No one's looked for these waves directly. You'll see why in a moment. The most impressive example was detected 10 years ago, in 66, by a team doing a survey of Iapetus. They obtained quite a long recording, rather sharply tuned at 9 kilohertz. That's 33 kilometers wavelength. I thought you might like to hear it. Duncan consulted a slip of paper and carefully tapped out a long sequence of numbers and letters on the minisec. Into the anechoic stillness of that strange room, Carl spoke from the grave in a brisk, businesslike voice. This is the complete recording, demodulated and speeded up 64 times so that 2 hours is compressed into 2 minutes, starting now. Across 20 years of time, a childhood memory suddenly came back to Duncan. He recalled listening out into the titanium night for that scream from the edge of space, wondering if it was indeed the voice of some monstrous beast, yet not really believing his own conjecture, even before Carl had demolished it. Now that fantasy returned, more powerful than ever. This sound, or rather infrasound, for the original modulation was far below the range of human hearing, was like the slow beating of a giant heart, or the tolling of a bell so huge that a cathedral could be placed inside it rather than the reverse. Or perhaps the waves of the sea, rolling forever in unvarying rhythm against some desolate shore on a world so old that though time still existed, change was dead. The recording, as it always did, set Duncan's skin crawling and sent shivers down his spine. And it brought back yet another memory. The image of that mightiest of all Earth's creatures leaping in power and glory into the sky above Golden Reef. Could there be beasts among the stars to whom men would be as insignificant as the lice upon the whale? It was a relief when the playback came to an end and Carl's surprisingly unemotional voice commented, "Note the remarkably constant frequency. The original period is 132 seconds, not varying by more than 0.1%. This implies a fairly high Q, say..." "The rest is technical," said Duncan, switching off the recording. "I merely wanted you to hear what the Iapetus survey team brought home with them. And it's something that could never have been picked up inside the orbit of Saturn." A voice he had not heard before, young, rather self-assured, came out of the air behind him. "But this is all old material, familiar to everyone in the field. Sandeman and Kuralsky showed that those signals were almost certainly relaxation oscillations, probably in a plasma cloud near one of Saturn's Trojan points." Duncan felt his facade of instant expertise rapidly crumbling. He should have guessed that there would be someone in his audience who would know far more about his subject than he did, and possibly, for that matter, even than Carl. "I'm not competent to discuss that," he replied. "I'm only reporting Dr. Helmer's opinions. He believed that there was a whole new science here waiting to be opened up. After all, every time we have explored some new region of the spectrum, it's led to astonishing and totally unexpected discoveries. Helmer was convinced that this would happen again. But to study these gigantic waves, up to a million times longer than those observed in classical radio astronomy, we must use correspondingly gigantic antenna systems. both to collect them, because they're very weak, and to determine the directions from which they come. This was Carl Helmer's Argus. His records and sketches contain quite detailed designs. I leave it to others to say how practical they are. Argus would look in all directions simultaneously, like the great missile-tracking radars of the 20th century. It would be the three-dimensional equivalent of Cyclops, and several hundred times larger, because it would need to be at least 1,000 kilometers in diameter, preferably 10,000 to get good resolving power at these ultra-low frequencies. Yet it need contain much less material than Cyclops, because it would be built in deep space, under weightless conditions. Helmer chose as its location the satellite Mnemosyne, outermost of Saturn's moons, and it seems a very logical choice, in fact the only choice. For Mnemosyne is 20 million kilometers from Saturn, well clear of the planet's own feeble ionosphere, and also far enough out for its tidal forces to be negligible. But most important of all, it has almost zero rotation. Only a modest amount of rocket power would cancel its spin entirely. Mnemosyne would then be the only body in the universe with no rotation at all, and Helmer suggests that it might be an ideal laboratory for various cosmological experiments. Such as a test of Mach's principle, interrupted that confident young voice. Yes, agreed Duncan, now more than ever impressed by his unknown critic. That was one possibility he mentioned. But back to Argus. Mnemosyne would serve as the core, or nucleus, of the array. Thousands of elements, little more than stiff wires, would radiate from it like the spines of a sea urchin. Thus it could comb the entire sky for signals. And incidentally, the temperature out around Mnemosyne is so low that cheap superconductors could be used, enormously increasing the efficiency of the system. I won't get involved in the details of switching and phasing that would allow Argus to swing its antenna spines electrically without moving them physically, so that it could concentrate on any particular region of the sky. All this, and a great deal more, Helmer had worked out in his notes, using techniques evolved with Cyclops and other radio telescopes. You may wonder, as I did, how he ever hoped to get such a gigantic project started. He planned a simple demonstration, which he was certain would provide enough evidence to prove his theories. He was going to launch two equal, massive weights in exactly opposite directions, each towing a fine wire several hundred kilometers long. When the wires had been completely deployed, the weights would be jettisoned, and he would have a simple dipole antenna, perhaps 1,000 kilometers long. He hoped that he could persuade the Solar Survey to do the experiment, which would be quite cheap, and would certainly produce some results of value. Then he was going to follow it up with the more ambitious schemes, shooting wires out at right angles and so on. But I think I've said enough to let you judge for yourselves. There's much more I've not had time to transcribe. I hope you can be patient, at least until after the centennial, for that, as you are well aware, is what I really came for, and I have work to do. Thank you for your moral support, Bob, said Duncan, when he and His Excellency, the Ambassador for Titan, had emerged into the bright sunlight of Virginia Avenue. I never said a word. I was completely out of my depth, and I kept hoping that someone would put the question I'm still anxious to see answered. What's that? Duncan asked suspiciously. How did Helmer think he could get away with it? Oh, that, said Duncan, mildly disappointed. This aspect of the matter seems so unimportant now. I think I understand his strategy. 4 years ago, when we turned down his project for a simple long-wave detecting system, because we couldn't afford it, and he wouldn't say what he was really driving at, he decided he'd have to go directly to Earth and convince the top scientists there. That meant acquiring funds, somehow. I'm sure he hoped that he'd be vindicated so quickly that we'd forget any minor infractions of the exchange laws. It was a gamble, of course, but he felt it so important that he was prepared to take risks. Said the ambassador, obviously not too impressed. I know that Helmer was a friend of yours, and I don't want to speak harshly of him, but wouldn't it be fair to call him a scientific genius and a criminal psychopath? Rather to his surprise, Duncan found himself bristling at this description, yet he had to admit it contained some truth. One of the attributes of the psychopath, a term still popular among laymen, despite 300 years of professional attempts to eradicate it, was a moral blindness to any interests but his own. Of course, Carl could always produce a very convincing argument that his interests were for the best of all concerned. The Mackenzies, Duncan realized with some embarrassment, were also skilled at this kind of exercise. If there were irrational elements in Carl's behavior, they were at least partly due to a breakdown he had 15 years ago. But that never affected his scientific judgment. Everyone I've spoken to agrees that Argus is sound. I don't doubt it, but why is it important? I'd hoped, said Duncan mildly, that I'd made that clear to our invisible friends. And I believe I have, he told himself, to at least one of them. His most penetrating questioner was certainly one of Terra's top radio astronomers. He would understand, and only a few allies at that level were necessary. Duncan was certain that someday they would meet again, this time eye to eye, and with a pointed lack of reference to any prior encounter. As to why it's important, Bob, I'll tell you something that I didn't mention to the committee, and which I'm sure Carl never considered because he was too engrossed in his own affairs. Do you realize what a project like Argus would do to the Titan economy? It would bring us billions and make us the scientific hub of the solar system. It might even go a long way to solve our financial problems when the demand for hydrogen starts to drop in the 80s. I appreciate that, Farrell answered dryly, especially as my taxes will go toward it. But let nothing interfere with the march of science. Duncan laughed sympathetically. He liked Bob Farrell, and he had been extremely helpful. But he was less and less sure of the ambassador's loyalties, and it might soon be time to find a replacement. Unfortunately, it would again have to be a Terran, because of this infernal gravity. But that was a problem Titan would always have to live with. He could certainly never tell his own ambassador, still less the Argus Committee, why Carl's brainchild might be so vital to the human race. There were speculations in that Menasek. Luckily, there was no hint of them in the sketchbook, which had best not be published for many years until the project had proved itself. Carl had been right so often in the past, seizing on truths beyond all bounds of logic and reason, that Duncan felt sure that this last awesome intuition was also correct. Or if it was not, the truth was even stranger. In any event, it was a truth that must be learned. Though the knowledge might be overwhelming, the price of ignorance could be extinction. Here on the streets of this beautiful city, steeped in sunlight and in history, it was hard to take Carl's final comments seriously, as he speculated about the origin of those mysterious waves. And surely even Carl did not really believe all the thoughts he had spoken into the secret memory of his Menasek during the long voyage to Earth. But he was diabolically persuasive, and his arguments had an irresistible logic and momentum of their own. Even if he did not believe all his own conjectures, he might still be right. Item one, he had murmured to himself. It must have been hard to get privacy on that freighter, and Duncan could sometimes hear the noises of the ship, the movements of the other crew members. These kilohertz waves have a limited range because of interstellar absorption. They would not normally be able to pass from one star to another unless plasma clouds act as waveguides, channeling them over greater distances, so their origin must be close to the solar system. My calculations all point to a source, or sources, at about a tenth of a light year from the sun, only a 40th of the way to Alpha Centauri, but 200 times the distance of Pluto. No man's land. The edge of the wilderness between the stars. But that's exactly where the comets are born, in a great invisible shell surrounding the solar system. There's enough material out there for a trillion of those strange objects orbiting in a cosmic freezer. What's going on in those huge clouds of hydrogen and helium and all the other elements? There's not much energy, but there may be enough. And where there's matter and energy and time, sooner or later, there's organization. Call them star beasts. Would they be alive? No, that word doesn't apply. Let's just say organized systems. They'd be hundreds or thousands of kilometers across, and they might live, I mean, maintain their individual identity for millions of years. That's a thought. The comets that we observe, are they the corpses of star beasts sent sunward for cremation? Or executed criminals? I'm being ridiculously anthropomorphic, but what else can I be? And are they intelligent? What does that word mean? Are ants intelligent? Are the cells of the human body intelligent? Do all the star beasts surrounding the solar system make a single entity? And does it know about us? Or does it care? Perhaps the sun keeps them at bay, as in ancient times the campfire kept off the wolves and saber-toothed tigers. But we are already a long way from the sun, and sooner or later we will meet them. The more we learn, the better. And there's one question I'm almost afraid to think about. Are they gods? Or are they eaters of gods? Chapter 41 Independence Day. Extract from the Congressional Record for 2276, July 4th. Address by the Honorable Duncan Mackenzie, Special Assistant to the Chief Administrator, Republic of Titan. Mr. Speaker, members of Congress, distinguished guests. Let me first express my deep gratitude to the Centennial Committee, whose generosity made possible my visit to Earth and to these United States. I bring greetings to all of you from Titan, largest of Saturn's many moons, and the most distant world yet occupied by mankind. 500 years ago, this land was also a frontier, not only geographically, but politically. Your ancestors, less than 20 generations in the past, created the first democratic constitution that really worked, and that still works today, on worlds that they could not have imagined in their wildest dreams. During these celebrations, many have spoken of the legacy that the founders of the Republic left us on that day, half a thousand years ago. But there have been four centennials since then. I would like to look briefly at each of them to see what lessons they have for us. At the first, in 1876, the United States was still recovering from a disastrous civil war. Yet it was also laying the foundations of the technological revolution that would soon transform the Earth. Perhaps it is no coincidence that in the very year of the first centennial, this country brought forth the invention which really began the conquest of space. For in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell made the first practical telephone. We take electronic communications so utterly for granted that we cannot imagine a society without them. We would be deaf and dumb if these extensions of our senses were suddenly removed. So let us remember that just 400 years ago, the telephone began the abolition of space, at least upon this planet. A century later, in 1976, that process had almost finished, and the conquest of interplanetary space was about to begin. By that time, the first man had already reached the moon, using techniques which today seem unbelievably primitive. Although all historians now agree that the Apollo project marked the United States' supreme achievement and its greatest moment of triumph, it was inspired by political motives that seem ludicrous, indeed incomprehensible, to our modern minds. And it is no reflection on those first engineers and astronauts that their brilliant pioneering effort was a technological dead end, and that serious space travel did not begin for several decades, with much more advanced vehicles and propulsion systems. A century later, in 2076, all the tools needed to open up the planets were ready to hand. Long-duration life support systems had been perfected. After the initial disasters, the fusion drive had been tamed. But humanity was exhausted by the effort of global rebuilding following the time of troubles, and in the aftermath of the population crash, there was little enthusiasm for the colonization of new worlds. Despite these problems, mankind had set its feet irrevocably on the road to the stars. During the 21st century, the lunar base became self-supporting. The Mars colony was established, and we had secured a bridgehead on Mercury. Venus and the gas giants defied us, as indeed they still do, but we had visited all the larger moons and asteroids of the solar system. By 2176, just 100 years ago, a substantial fraction of the human race was no longer Earthborn. For the first time, we had the assurance that whatever happened to the mother world, our cultural heritage would not be lost. It was secure until the death of the sun, and perhaps beyond. The century that lies behind us has been one of consolidation, rather than a fresh discovery. I'm proud that my world has played a major role in this process, for without the easily accessible hydrogen of the Titanian atmosphere, travel between the planets would still be exorbitantly expensive. Now the old question arises. Where do we go from here? The stars are as remote as ever. Our first probes, after 2 centuries of travel, have yet to reach Proxima Centauri, the sun's closest neighbor. Though our telescopes can now see to the limits of space, no man has yet traveled beyond Pluto. And we have still to set foot on far Persephone, which we could have reached at any time during the last 100 years. Is it true, as many have suggested, that the frontier has again closed? Men have believed that before, and always they have been wrong. We can laugh now at those early 20th century pessimists who lamented that there were no more worlds to discover. At the very moment when Goddard and Korolev and von Braun were playing with their first primitive rockets, and earlier still, just before Columbus opened the way to this continent, it must have seemed to the peoples of Europe that the future could hold nothing to match the splendors of the past. I do not believe that we have come to the end of history, and that what lies ahead is only an elaboration and extension of our present powers on planets already discovered. Yet it cannot be denied that this feeling is now widespread and makes itself apparent in many ways. There is an unhealthy preoccupation with the past, and an attempt to reconstruct or relive it. Not, I hasten to add, that this is always bad. What we are doing now proves that it is not. We should respect the past, but not worship it. While we look back upon the 4 centennials that lie behind us, we should think also of those that will be celebrated in the years to come. What of 2376, 2476, 2776, a full 1,000 years after the birth of the Republic? How will the people of those days remember us? We remember the United States chiefly by Apollo. Can we bequeath any comparable achievement to the ages ahead? There are many problems still to be solved on all the planets. Unhappiness, disease, even poverty still exist. We are still far from utopia, and we may never achieve it. But we know that all these problems can be solved with the tools that we already possess. No pioneering, no great discoveries are necessary here. Now that the worst evils of the past have been eliminated, we can look elsewhere with a clear conscience for new tasks to challenge the mind and inspire the spirit. Civilization needs long-range goals. Once, the solar system provided them. But now we must look beyond. I'm not speaking of man to travel to the stars, which may still lie centuries ahead. What I refer to is the quest for intelligence in the universe, which was begun with such high hopes more than 3 centuries ago, and has not yet succeeded. You are all familiar with Cyclops, the largest radio telescope on Earth. That was built primarily to search for evidence of advanced civilizations. It transformed astronomy. But despite many false alarms, it never detected a single intelligent message from the stars. This failure has done much to turn men's minds inward from the greater universe, to concentrate their energies upon the tiny oasis of the solar system. Could it be that we are looking in the wrong place? The wrong place, that is, in the enormously wide spectrum of radiations that travel between the stars. All our radio telescopes have searched the short waves, centimeters or at most meters in length. But what of the long and ultra-long waves, not only kilometers but even megameters from crest to crest? Radio waves of frequencies so low that they would sound like musical notes if our ears could detect them. We know that such waves exist, but we have never been able to study them here on Earth. They are blocked far out in the fringes of the solar system by the gale of electrons that blows forever from the sun. To know what the universe is saying with these vast, slow undulations, we must build radio telescopes of enormous size, beyond the limits of the sun's own billion-kilometer-deep ionosphere, that is, at least as far out as the orbit of Saturn. For the first time, this is now possible. For the first time, there are real incentives for doing so. We tend to judge the universe by our own physical size and our own time scale. It seems natural for us to work with waves that we could span with our arms or even with our fingertips. But the cosmos is not built to these dimensions, nor perhaps are all the entities that dwell among the stars. These giant radio waves are more commensurate with the scale of the Milky Way, and their slow vibrations are a better measure of its eon-long galactic year. They may have much to tell us when we begin to decipher their messages. How those scientist statesmen Franklin and Jefferson would have welcomed such a project. They would have grasped its scope, if not its technology, for they were interested in every branch of knowledge between heaven and earth. The problems they faced 500 years ago will never rise again. The age of conflict between nations is over. But we have other challenges, which may yet tax us to the utmost. Let us be thankful that the universe can always provide great goals beyond ourselves and enterprises to which we can pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Duncan Mackenzie closed the beautifully designed souvenir book as a masterpiece of the printer's art, such as had not been seen for centuries and might never be seen again. Only 500 copies had been produced, one for every year. He would carry his back in triumph to Titan, where for the rest of his life it would be among his most cherished possessions. Many people had complimented him on his speech, enshrined forever in these pages, and much more accessibly in library memories and information banks throughout the solar system. Yet he had felt embarrassed to receive those plaudits, for in his heart he knew that he had not earned them. The Duncan of a few weeks ago could never have conceived that address. He was little more than a medium, passing on a message from the dead. The words were his, but all the thoughts were Carl's. How astonished, he told himself wryly, all his friends on Titan must have been when they watched the ceremony. Perhaps it had been slightly inappropriate to use such a forum as this for what might be considered self-serving propaganda, even special pleading on behalf of his own world. But Duncan had a clear conscience, and as yet there had been no criticism on this score. Even those who were baffled by his thesis had been grateful for the excitement he had injected into all the routine formalities. And even if his speech was only a 7-day wonder to the general public, it would not be forgotten. He had planted a seed. One day it would grow on barren Mnemosyne. Meanwhile, there was a slight practical problem, though it was not yet urgent. This splendid volume, with its thick vellum and its tool leather binding, weighed about 5 kilograms. The Mackenzies hated waste and extravagance. It would be pleasant to have the book on the voyage home, but excess baggage to Titan was 100 solars a kilo. It would have to go back by slow boat, on one of the empty tankers. Unaccompanied freight may be stowed in vacuum. Chapter 42. The Mirror of the Sea. Dr. Yehudi Ben Mohammed did not look as if he belonged in a modern hospital, surrounded by flickering life function displays, console readouts, whispering voices from hidden speakers, and all the aseptic technology of life and death. In his spotless white robes, with the double circlet of golden cord around his headdress, he should have been holding court in a desert tent or scanning the horizon from the back of his camel for the first glimpse of an oasis. Duncan remembered how one of the younger doctors had commented during his first visit, "Sometimes I think El-Hajj believes he's a reincarnation of Saladin and Lawrence of Arabia." Although Duncan did not understand the full flavor of the references, this was obviously said more in affectionate jest than in criticism. Did the surgeon, he wondered, wear those robes in the operating theater? They would not be inappropriate there, and certainly they did not interfere with the feline grace of his movements. "I'm glad," said Dr. Yehudi, toying with the jeweled dagger on his elaborately inlaid desk. The two touches of antiquity in an otherwise late 23rd century environment, "that you've finally made up your mind. The delay has caused certain problems, but we've overcome them. We now have 4 perfectly viable embryos, and the first will be transplanted in a week. The others will be kept as backups in case of a rejection, though that is now very rare." "And what will happen to the unwanted 3? Duncan asked himself, and shied away from the answer. One human being had been created who would never otherwise have existed. That was the positive side. Better to forget the 3 ghosts who for a brief while had hovered on the borders of reality. Yet it was hard to be coldly logical in matters like this. As he stared across the intricate arabesques, Duncan wondered at the psychology of the calm and elegant figure whose skillful hands had controlled so many destinies. In their own small way, on their own little world, the Mackenzies had played at God, but this was something beyond his understanding. Of course, one could always take refuge in the cold mathematics of reproduction. Old Mother Nature had not the slightest regard for human ethics or feelings. In the course of a lifetime, every man generated enough spermatozoa to populate the entire solar system many times over, and all but 2 or 3 of that potential multitude were doomed. Had anyone ever gone mad by visualizing each ejaculation as 100 million murders? Quite possibly. No wonder that the adherents of some old religions had refused to look through the microscope. There were moral obligations and uncertainties behind every act. In the long run, a man could only obey the promptings of that mysterious entity called conscience, and hope that the outcome would not be too disastrous. Not, of course, that one could ever know the final results of any actions. Strange, thought Duncan, how he had resolved the doubts that had assailed him when he first came to the island. He had learned to take the broader view, and to place the hopes and aspirations of the Mackenzies in a wider context. Above all, he had seen the dangers of overreaching ambition. But the lesson of Carl's fate was still ambiguous, and would give him cause to wonder all his life. With a mild sense of shock, Duncan realized that he had already signed the legal documents and was returning them to Dr. Yehudi. No matter. He had read them carefully and knew his responsibilities. "I, Duncan Mackenzie, resident of the satellite Titan, presently in orbit around the planet Saturn..." When did the lawyers think it was going to run away? "Do hereby accept guardianship of 1 cloned male child, identified by the chromosome chart herewith attached, and will to the best of my ability, etc., etc., etc." Perhaps the world would have been a better place if the parents of normally conceived children had been forced to sign such a contract. This thought, however, was some 100 billion births too late. The surgeon flowed upward to his full commanding 2 meters in a gesture of dismissal which, from anyone else, would have seemed slightly discourteous, but not here, for El-Hajj had much on his mind. All the while they'd been talking, his eyes had seldom strayed from the pulsing lines of life and death on the readouts that covered almost 1 whole wall of his office. In the main hall of the administration building, Duncan paused for a moment before the giant, slowly rotating DNA helix, which dominated the entrance. As his gaze roamed along the spokes of the twisted ladder, contemplating its all but infinite possibilities, he could not help thinking again of the pentominoes that Grandma Ellen had set out before him years ago. There were only 12 of those shapes, yet it would take the lifetime of the universe to exhaust their possibilities, and here was no mere dozen, but billions upon billions of locations to be filled by the letters of the genetic code. The total number of combinations was not one to stagger the mind, because there was no way whatsoever in which the mind could grasp even the faintest conception of it. The number of electrons required to pack the entire cosmos, solid from end to end, was virtually zero in comparison. Duncan stepped out into the blazing sunlight, waited for his dark glasses to adjust themselves, and set off in search of Dr. Todd, guide and friend of his previous visit. He would not be leaving for another 4 hours, and there was one major item of business still to be settled. Luckily, as Sweeney Todd explained, there was no need to go out to the reef. I can't imagine why you're interested in those ugly beasts. But you'll find some on a patch of dead coral at the end of that groin. Not much else will live there. The water's only a meter deep. You won't even need flippers, just a strong pair of shoes. If you do step on a stonefish, your screams will bring us in time to save your life, though you may wish we hadn't. That was not very encouraging. But 10 minutes later, Duncan was cautiously walking out into the shallows, bent double as he peered through his borrowed face mask. There was none of the beauty here that he had seen on the approach to Golden Reef. The water was crystal clear, but the seabed was a submarine desert. It was mostly white sand, mingled with broken pieces of coral, like the bleached bones of tiny animals. A few small, drably colored fish were swimming around, and others stared at him with anxious, unfriendly eyes from little burrows in the sand. Once a brilliantly blue creature, like a flattened eel, came darting at him, and to his great surprise gave him a painful nip before he chased it away. It was every bit of 3 centimeters long, and Duncan, who had never heard of cleaning symbiosis, worried about poison for a few minutes. However, he felt no pangs of imminent dissolution, so pushed his way onward through the tepid water. The concrete groin, part of the island's defense against the ceaseless erosion of the waves, stretched out for 100 meters from the shore and then disappeared beneath the surface. Near its seaward end, Duncan came across a pile of jumbled rocks, perhaps hurled up by some storm. They must have been here for many years, for they were cemented together with barnacles and small jagged oysters. Among their caves and crevices, Duncan found what he was seeking. Each sea urchin appeared to have hollowed out its own cavity in the hard rock. Duncan could not imagine how the creatures had performed this remarkable feat of burrowing. Anchored securely in place with only a bristling frieze of black spines exposed to the outer world, they were invulnerable to all enemies except man. But Duncan wished them no harm, and this time had not even brought a knife. He had seen enough of death, and his sole purpose now was to confirm, or refute, the impression that had haunted him ever since he had set eyes on that drawing in Carl's notebook. Once again, the long black spines started to swing slowly toward his shadow. These primitive creatures, despite their apparent lack of sense organs, knew that he was there, and reacted to his presence. They were scanning their little universe as Argus would search the stars. Of course, there would be no actual physical movement of the Argus antennas. That was unnecessary, and would be impossible with such fragile 1,000-kilometer-long structures. Yet their electronic sweeping of the skies would have an uncanny parallel with Diadema's protective reaction. If some planet-sized monster, which used ultra-long radio waves for vision, could observe the Argus system at work, what it saw would be not unlike this humble reef dweller. For a moment, Duncan had a curious fantasy. He imagined that he was such a monster, observing Argus in silhouette against the background radio glow of the galaxy. There would be hundreds of thin black lines radiating out from a central point, most of them stationary, but some of them waving slowly back and forth as if responding to a shadow from the stars.